Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 578. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois. We're back with another episode. We've had one every Friday for almost 11 years. The anniversary's coming up, Jeff. Let me introduce to you one of the brothers who was on one of those first episodes, one of the co-founders of Reform Forum, even before it was Reform Forum. We have Jeff Waddington, Stated Supply of Knox OPC in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania, calling in from Norristown. Isn't that how they say it out there?
Norristown.
Welcome back, Jeff. It's great to talk to you.
Good to be here to have our guest. Before we go any further, I just wanted to plug this book that Carl co-authored with Robert Kolb, titled Between Wittenberg and Geneva, Lutheran and Reformed Theology in Conversation. And there is a great chapter on the Lord's Supper, which we're going to be talking about in this during this conversation.
I love it. Thanks, Jeff. I can sit back. You're doing my job for me. Let me introduce to you. We do have a guest. We do want to introduce our friend, Dr. Carl Truman, who is a professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College. He's also one of the co-hosts or panelists, I don't know what you call yourselves over there, at the Mortification of Spin with the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. Welcome back, Carl. It's great to talk to you, too.
Great to talk to you, Camden. I think it's a few years since I was last on.
I think so. It's not intentional.
I didn't take it personally. But we met up in that little room above what was the bookstore at Westminster, I think.
Oh, no. You've been on. I think if I'm not mistaken, the last time we spoke to you perhaps was when we talked about Luther on the Christian Life. So that was over the internet. Right. But yeah, we used to have that little spot. We had kind of it was kind of this arrangement at Westminster where they allowed us to use an old bookstore office on campus to record. So some of those older episodes where we had videos, the listeners and viewers can know that we moved around throughout, you know, these 11 years, and that was a good stop for us for a couple.
Yeah, was the old office for Lane and myself and a few of our other colleagues.
Yeah, in the carriage house upstairs.
We worked at the bookstore. That was the packing room, and I had a little office in the back in the cubby hole.
I visited once when the bookstore was still up there, but then I guess some structural engineers said that you shouldn't have that many books upstairs.
Yep, that's what I was told.
People on the stairs.
So they moved them, and they moved off campus, and now it's still off campus. But you can head on over to WTSbooks.com. You pick up a copy of that book. And Dr. Truman, of course, an expert on history and theology of Martin Luther, and for many, many, many years taught church history at Westminster Theological Seminary, so we're happy to have him on today to talk about the Marburg Colloquy, a really important event in Reformation history, and it touches upon a lot of things, social issues, it touches upon political issues at the time, but perhaps most known for touching upon the doctrine of the Lord's Supper and some of the different forms of that doctrine among Protestantism. So we're going to talk about that today, but you've got a couple things to mention. As usual, I encourage you to visit us online at the website reformedforum.org. We've got some events coming up. We've been pushing it a lot lately, but Lane Tipton will be teaching a seminar, 12-lecture seminar in Wimberley, Texas, April 2nd through 4th. And the event info is all online. You can register for that today. And if you'd like to, you can stay along with us. We're going to be down there for the whole week, hanging out and learning and about things and talking about Reformed theology. That's coming up really soon. We're working on the details of our theology conference in October. I know some people usually like to know about that, have a heads up on that, and especially this time of year, people might be planning vacation or time off from work. If you're not a federal employee, you need to ask for time off of work. If you are a federal employee, who knows if you'll be working by then. You can come and visit us October 11th and 12th in Grays Lake, Illinois for that. We're looking forward to having people back here at Hope Presbyterian for the conference. Those are just two things coming up here at Reform Forum, and it seems like a long ways away to think about October or even perhaps April, but we all know that it'll sneak up on us sooner than later. So all that info is online, reformedforum.org. So gentlemen, let's get into our point of conversation today. We got some really interesting things to speak of. Dr. Truman, you know, you taught the Reformation class for a long time. I think you called it at one point Luther and some other guys.
I did. That was basically how I taught it.
I think it was more than 50% of the lectures at least were focused on Luther, but there's a reason for that. I mean, it's not, you know, he's such a key figure, but and an early reformer thinking about all of those, all of the things with his life and how that played out. It's certainly, you can't understand the Reformation without understanding Luther. But when we're talking about the Marburg Colloquy, we almost can't just start there about the event. We need to back up. But even before we do that, could you maybe lay out the land for us and explain to us what this colloquy is, this meeting, and give us just a thumbnail sketch before we start to think about how it arose?
Sure. Well, the year, it takes place in the year 1529 in the city of Marburg. 1529 is a critical year in the Reformation because after the Diet of Worms in 1521, the question of how to handle the rising Protestant movements within the empire had become a pressing one for the Holy Roman Empire, effectively the secular authority of Central Europe, we might say. And in 1526, at what's called the First Diet of Speyer, a kind of compromise had been reached that left the door open for a potential way of moving forward that might accommodate the various religious factions within the empire. In March 1529, a second diet, imperial diet, a sort of council meeting, if you like, meets in the city of Speyer and definitively closes that door in a way that puts the Lutherans in a very vulnerable position and basically puts the Reformers and the Anabaptists, the Reformed and the Anabaptists, right on the outside and vulnerable to persecution. In the case of the Anabaptists, the death penalty. So the Protestant situation in 1529 is pretty tense. And Philip of Hesse, the Landgrave of Hesse, a German noble, decides that it would be very useful if some kind of alliance could be forged between the Lutheran cities and states in the north and the Swiss Reformed cities and some imperial Reformed cities in the south and the west. So he calls this meeting at the Marburg, at the castle in Marburg, where the hope is that the leading theologians of the two traditions that are represented there will find some kind of common theological ground in order to build a political alliance, a sort of mutual protective alliance to face down the potentially hostile forces of the empire. It's a little weird to us to think in those terms because by and large today, foreign policy doesn't rest upon theological agreement. Matters, but of course, right. in the 16th century, it's very, very important that alliances take account of theological common ground and agree to tolerate certain theological differences. It's just the way society is structured. So the Marburg Colloquy, in its primary intention, is really an attempt to forge a theological confessional basis for a kind of mutual defense league for Lutherans and Reformed.
Now, you know, when we study Ulrich Zwingli or Huldrych Zwingli, depending on which spelling you want to take, Latinized version or not, you definitely see a lot of these things at work with him too, in terms of he was seeking to find various alliances and whatnot, but he was a much more militant person, not just in terms of his affect, but actually quite literally. He died in battle and was, you know, was working with mercenaries and whatnot. But I'm wondering if you could teach us a little bit about the similarities and differences between these Germanic lands and what was going on in Switzerland. And in Switzerland, you have the different cantons. And some of them are Catholic. Some of them are Reformed, Protestant. And then in the Germanic areas where Luther was, clearly having Philip there was very helpful and useful to him. But we're kind of so removed from the history, we don't always understand how some of these civil authorities operated.
Yes, I mean, in some ways, the differences between the Lutheran and the Reformed Reformations, the German and the Swiss Reformations, we might say. A little bit anachronistic to talk about that way, but it's a helpful way of dividing them. The differences are almost as significant as the similarities. I mean, no doubt we will probe some of the theological commonalities and differences later. But it's very important to realize that Luther and Zwingli are operating in very, very different political contexts. Luther is operating in a kind of medieval, feudal-type, noble context, where really the prince of the territory, the senior nobleman, essentially calls the shots. Now, of course, no nobleman has absolute power. There's always negotiation that's going on with various stakeholders. But essentially, the prince calls the shots and sets the agenda. And in practice, for Luther, this meant that he was very much dependent upon the prince's take on things, and he exerted very, very little what we might now call direct political power. Clearly, he had huge influence. He was an iconic figure, we would say today. He exerted tremendous influence on the popular imagination, but he didn't have much formal political power. Zwingli, on the other hand, is very significant, not only church-wise, but also politically. His territory is the city of Zurich. Zurich is an independent city. So it's a city that's not part of the Holy Roman Empire. It's not directly beholden to the policies of the emperor, though clearly the emperor has an interest in what's going on in Zurich because he doesn't want it becoming a center that might lead to the destabilization of imperial territories. And it's also governed by a town council. Now, again, we shouldn't think of a town council as being as democratic as say we have today. Mm-hmm. Incidentally, I think Switzerland only gave women the vote in the 1970s. So we definitely don't want to think about modern democracy in 16th century Switzerland. Yeah. But the town council was elected and enjoyed direct power. And Zwingli was initially in Zurich. He's the minister of the great Minster in Zurich. And then in the early 1520s, he moves to being effectively chaplain at large for the town council. So you have a situation in Zurich where the civil authorities and the religious authorities, we might say, are hopelessly confused looking at it from a kind of American First Amendment kind of framework. But perhaps a better way of putting it is they work hand in glove. And Zwingli has tremendous direct political power in a way that Luther does not enjoy. And that also tracks, I think, into a deeper and perhaps less easy to define cultural difference between the two men. And that is, Zwingli is very much a man of the emerging modern age. He's a man of the city. He's a man where trade, social mobility, these kind of things are becoming significant factors in the way people think about themselves. Luther, I think you sat in on my Reformation classes, Camden. I would say Luther was in many ways the last man of the Middle Ages. His calling is that of a monk. He comes to Reformation in middle age. He really sees the world in the rather more fixed and hierarchical way than Zwingli would. So there are very significant political and cultural differences between the two men, primarily grounded in their different geographical contexts.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. It's interesting to study and look more at Zwingli, and I wonder about just his personal, his personality, his constitution and whatnot. And it seems as if, at this era in 1529, he recognized that there was some need to have some sort of an alliance because they were being, in essence, the Reformed people in the Catholic cantons were being barred from worshiping in the way that they thought was according to Scripture. And he wanted to do something about it and tried to form an alliance. And he had some varying degrees of success, but eventually, he was able to negotiate or work out a combined force, or Zurich was at least able to go forward and fight against the Catholics. And then the Austrians, whom the Catholics had formed an alliance with, bailed on them, and they lost this battle, which was, I guess, known as the First War of Koppel. That came back, it seems, to bite Zwingli in the end, because did he not die at the Second War of Koppel?
He did.
And the same thing happened. He thought that he had, you know, or was trying to work out these alliances, but in the end, it was unsuccessful. But he was so, it seemed as if so gung-ho or zealous that he was going into fight maybe when he didn't have the necessary resources to be successful.
Yeah, I think there is an innate radicalism in the Zurich Reformation that you don't find so much in Luther. You certainly get it in certain Lutherans. Yeah. But again, Luther's need to make sure that the elector is okay with what he's doing. The only right. thing stopping Luther being extradited to Rome and executed, handed over to church authorities, is the whim of the elector. That, I think, imposes a certain external slowness and conservatism on the Lutheran Reformation. You know, 1522 is a key year for Luther when he's been hiding in the Wartburg Castle after the Diet of Worms, and he has to return to Wittenberg because riots, iconoclastic riots, have broken out. There is Anabaptist influence coming in, and some of the more gung-ho Lutheran leaders are pressing for a more thorough iconoclastic form of Reformation. Luther has to come back to bring peace to the streets of Wittenberg, precisely because if the elector thinks the social situation is flying out of control, he'll just hand Luther over and take it back 5 years, effectively. So there's a conservatism there. I also think that the two men, Zwingli, again, as a man of the modern age, is probably just a more iconoclastic personality because of the urban context in which he lives.
Interesting.
Luther is, I say, more of a medieval man. Yeah. His writings on vocation are very, very conservative in many ways.
It's kind of wild to think about Luther as the conservative guy, because we tend to kind of latch on to his bombastic statements and his big personality. But it seems as if he did think of Zwingli in a certain way. McCulloch, at least, you know, kind of indicates that Luther might have thought of Zwingli and his ilk as a Schwärmer, or more in line with the Zwickau prophets, or somebody like Thomas Münster.
Yeah, no doubt that's the case with Luther. I think that I used to use this analogy in class, going back to the troubles in Northern Ireland, that in Northern Ireland you have the terrorist group, the IRA, blowing up shopping malls, maiming and killing people. And you have Sinn Féin, you've got the IRA with their balaclavas, and you've got the Sinn Féin leaders with their Armani suits appearing on television and presenting the political wing of things. I think for Luther, Zwingli was just the Sinn Féin of the Anabaptist movement in many ways. He was the respectable facade that was hiding lunacy and craziness behind the scenes. So, yeah, when Luther receives news of Zwingli's death, the only comment he makes at dinner that night is something to the effect of, "Well, those who live by the sword shall die by the sword." There's not an ounce of human sympathy or kindness shown towards Zwingli in that comment.
And I guess we'll get to it when they debate, but it seems that at a few points he almost brought Zwingli to tears in their arguments.
Oh, yes. He was a thug without a shadow of doubt. You can be conservative and a thug is the lesson, I think, from Luther.
He said it. Oh, so tell us more about Philip, Landgrave Philip the First of Hesse, and about his kind of protection of Luther, if we can call it that, but and his real motivation here, as this colloquy is called, and it was called at his castle, was it not?
Yes, and I think Philip is one of the sort of the tragic. Tragically conflicted figures of the Reformation. He first appears in the Luther story in 1521 at the Diet of Worms, when Luther arrives in Worms to engage in debate but effectively to be tried before the emperor. Numerous great and good come to visit him to ask him for pastoral advice, and Philip is one of those, and the advice he wants from Luther is a sexual advice relative to his his wife. So he's I think Americans would say Philip is clearly a man with issues. Later in Luther's career, he's actually the focal point of one of the great scandals of Luther's life, because again, a sexual issue. He asks Luther's advice. He really doesn't like the lady he's married to.
Yeah, he doesn't find her attractive, right?
Doesn't find her attractive. Falling in love with a much younger woman. Wants Luther's advice on, you know, how to deal with this. Now, on one level, you've got to say, well, at least he's wrestling with it. You know, many nobles would just have taken a mistress.
Right, so, well, Zwingli.
Let's give him some marks for wrestling with the problem. Right. But Luther's advice, and Melanchthon's too, is eventually, look, why don't you just, you know, the patriarchs were polygamists. Just marry a second wife, but don't tell anybody about it, and definitely don't tell anybody that we've given you this advice.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, three men can keep a secret if two of them are dead, and you know, that story is just too good. So that gets out, and actually becomes part of the Catholic.
Oh yeah, the rhetoric
standard trope that the Reformation is all about sexual license. So
well, that happened was Zwingli too a little bit. I mean, he had a scandal when he was younger, but it, you know, turned out the woman is a harlot and she had seduced many people. But his competitor, I guess the other guy up for the job, I think at Grossmünster, had like five affairs. So,
I mean, concubinage was routinely tolerated in the Middle Ages. Yeah. And yeah, before we're too hard on these guys, there's a sense in which in an era with very limited contraceptive technology, it was much harder to get away with. I'm not sure we're any better today. It's just that people are able to get away
people
with
are able
it.
To hide their indiscretions or sins. Yeah.
So, but Philip, eventually he's part of the Schmalkaldic League, which is formed in the early 1530s. It is the Lutheran Mutual Defense Alliance, which is essentially smashed to pieces in 1547, a year after the death of Luther, and Philip spends some time in prison at the emperor's pleasure after that. So Philip is, I think he's a tormented character, but he is probably the biggest and most imaginative Lutheran political figure, if you like, of the 1520s and 30s. And the Schmalkaldic League is no mean achievement. It protects Lutheranism for 15, 16 years, right up until the death of Luther himself.
Jeff, you want to jump in? You got any questions?
I'm enjoying this.
Me too.
I was just reminded that you think about the advice that was offered to Philip. It just reminded me of the advice that the Archbishop of Canterbury, Cranmer, had offered to Henry VIII. So, you know, all of these gentlemen, you know, church leaders are put in, you know, rather awkward situations because of their context. Situations that I suppose we're thankful we're not in. It's a different world altogether. And as you've said, Carl, history is a foreign country. But it's good to know this, because theology is not detached from real life, right? And so when we look at the issue of the Lord's Supper, this is part and parcel of the Christian life in Europe at this point, an integral part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, speaking then more on the theological side of the Marburg Colloquy, it's interesting to note of how really in some ways seminal the documents or the agreements were coming out of this. I believe there are 13 points of doctrine that Zwingli and Luther were able to agree upon. Bucer was very much involved in this, the supreme ecumenist trying to get these two brothers on board. But what were some of the issues coming in that might have presented, you know, differences starting out? Yeah. What are some of the theological reasons that gave rise to the need for a Marburg Colloquy? Was it more than just the Lord's Supper, or was that even at the very beginning kind of the real sticking point?
If you look at Luther, if you compare Lutheran theology or Luther's theology to Zwingli's theology, there are definitely differences in emphases. Justification by grace through faith, for example, which is absolutely central to Luther and will become, you know, central to Calvin as well, is is somewhat conspicuous by its absence from Zwingli. My doctoral supervisor, Peter Stevens, did his work on Bucer and Zwingli. And I remember in one of my seminar discussions with him when I was starting my PhD, and him highlighting the comparative lack of discussions of justification in Zwingli that surprised me. Now, of course, the lack of emphasis doesn't necessarily mean fundamental disagreement in content. Though it has to be said, when you look at Zwingli's allusions to justification, he's perhaps more kind of Augustinian / transformative than Luther would have been. But that's not a major bone of contention between them as far as I can see. Mm-hmm. If Zwingli, if we're looking for an emphasis in Zwingli then that we don't find in Luther, I think Zwingli's emphasis on providence is a powerful one, and arising in some ways out of very distinct pastoral situation, where 1519 to 1520, the plague comes to Zurich, and 25% of the inhabitants of Zurich are wiped out by plague. And this drives Zwingli to reflect upon the sovereignty of God and upon the nature of God's providence in a way that was never quite the case for Luther. So with Zwingli, we have, Luther, we have justification. With Zwingli, we perhaps have sovereignty. Mm-hmm. But having said that, those weren't major points of tension between them. The big one is the Lord's Supper, and very specifically, whether the whole Christ, divine and human, is present, to use the terminology of later Lutheranism, in, with, and under the elements of bread and wine. Yeah. In medieval theology, as you guys know, the thinking was that at the moment of consecration, the substance of the bread and wine changed into the substance of the body and blood of the Lord Jesus Christ. Not that there was anemic flesh in the bread and just blood in the wipes. The whole Christ became the substance of both elements. So all that was left was an appearance of bread and wine, not any real bread and
wine. The accident, yeah.
Yeah. Luther, pretty early on in his career, gets rid of that idea and has Christ present, the whole Christ, divine and human, present in the bread and the wine. And that will become the big bone of contention with the Zwinglians. Mm-hmm. The way that becomes so is a somewhat convoluted story, but really goes to the heart of why Marburg becomes such a big deal and divides Lutheran and Reformed. In fact, Jeff very kindly did a plug for the book I did with my good pal Bob Kolb. And when the book came out, around about the time the book came out, I remember having dinner with Bob. I think we were down at Baylor University together, speaking at a conference, and we were having dinner or lunch together. And he made the comment that he expected to be beaten up in some conservative Lutheran quarters, really? Metaphorically speaking, for even writing a book like that with a Reformed person. And yeah, I'm sitting there.
Well, certainly in the Wisconsin evangelical Lutherans.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And on the conservative wing of the Missouri Synod. Whereas as a Reformed guy, it never crossed my mind that any Reformed person they might say to me, this was a pointless exercise perhaps, but I didn't think that anyone would see it as an exercise involving a fundamental compromise of the gospel.
Right, yeah.
So it's
really
the decade.
Crypto-Lutheran.
Yeah, and there's a long way between the Luther of 1519, 1520 and the Luther of 1529 that explains exactly why the stakes get so high in 1529.
Well, feel free to draw some of that out. We'd love to hear more if there's ever a place to do that. It would be on this program.
Right. I've run out of time. I've got to have to leave you.
At least some of the high points. We can know where to go to read and study more.
We need to go back first of all to Luther's own early Reformation theology, say 1515 to 1520, where most people, if you ask them what's the breakthrough, would say justification by grace through faith. That crystallizes the breakthrough, and that's certainly true. But another aspect of that is that Luther became convinced that the answer to his question, where can I find a gracious God, is found in the flesh of the Lord Jesus Christ. Where do I go to find God gracious to me? For Luther, that has to have an incarnational answer. I have to come across God manifest in the flesh. To the point he'll say at times later in his creed, you know, don't show me God without showing me the flesh. Mm-hmm. Because the God outside the flesh is the scary God of judgment. It's only, you know, to use somewhat rhetorical language, it's only God has made himself small and weak in the incarnation that I can approach him.
Is that where we see then, you know, crystallize the theology of the cross in him?
Yeah. 1518 at Heidelberg, when Luther articulates this so-called theology of the cross. This is the idea underlying it. You see it in the aesthetics of Lutheran churches. When you go into Lutheran churches, the crucifixes are not there for you to worship them so much as they are to remind you that God became small and died for you in the flesh of the Lord Jesus Christ. So hold that in mind. Luther, right from the get-go in the Reformation, has what we might describe as an almost pathological concern for finding the incarnation. When you proclaim the word, you've got to point people to the incarnate Christ. When you administer the sacraments, the incarnate Christ has got to be there for them to be gospel ordinances. The famous painting of Luther preaching, where he's standing in the pulpit and his hand is on the Bible, it's the word, and his finger is extended, pointing to the crucified Christ. That is, for Luther, the pastor's task in pictorial form. You preach the word to point to the broken flesh of Christ in the incarnation, to point people to God as gracious. So, then when you look at Luther's early writings on the Lord's Supper, what's interesting is he takes the presence of Christ's flesh for granted. His criticism in 1520 of transubstantiation is not that it makes the flesh and blood of Christ present. It's that it gets rid of the blood, bread and the wine. He said, you know, this is exegetically unsustainable. Jesus said, this bread is my body. Yeah. You know, the bread's got to be there if Jesus is saying this is bread. If he's predicating breadness of this thing, the bread has got to be there. So really we have a situation where the bread's there, the wine's there, but mysteriously the flesh and blood of Christ are there as well. So that's all well and good at that point. 1521, 1522, he's away in the Marburg castle, so many castles involved.
The
Wartburg castle, thank you. And the leadership of the Lutheran Reformation in Wittenberg passes to a number of other younger guys, and also his colleague, a man called Andreas Bodenstein von Karstadt. In the early stage of the Reformation, it's arguable that Karstadt is almost senior to Luther. Certainly they're kind of sort of equals. They both go to Leipzig to debate John Eck in 1519. Luther, I think, was destined to be the greater of the two because he was just a better operator. Karlstadt is somewhat long-winded and not the smartest.
He kind of alienated operator. People too, didn't he?
Yeah, he was not a... Yeah, I mean, he was a classic talented guy whose people skills and ability to judge situations was going to to prevent him from realizing his full potential.
I see.
Karstadt takes over the Reformation in Luther's absence and really implements these quite radical reforms. Iconoclasm comes in. He himself starts dressing as a peasant, administering the mass in a plain robe. And he introduces this new understanding of the words of institution. It's new to Wittenberg. It's not unprecedented in the medieval period, but it's new to Wittenberg, where he takes the sentence, "This is my body," as Christ referring to his physical body, and then "do this," i.e. have the bread and the wine in remembrance of me, is referring to the bread and wine. So he really eliminates any need for any notion of presence. And this symbolic understanding is anathema to Luther. Mm-hmm. It's anathema theologically because suddenly that which Luther thinks needs to be there, the body and blood of the Lord Jesus Christ, is gone. But secondly, and I think critically for understanding relations with Zwingli, it links in Luther's mind the idea of symbolic presence or talking about the spirit all the time, which Karlstadt and his buddies did, and spiritual presence with craziness. This goes to what I said earlier about this is why Luther regards Zwingli as the polite face of psychotic revolutionary nutcases.
The Schwärmer or whatever that.
Yeah,
that
the Schwärmer, the swarms. Yeah. You know, the idea is the bees, mm-hmm. the crew. And ever after, when Luther, we would say today, Luther gets kind of triggered by language of spiritual presence or the spirit. To thinking of the craziness.
He needed a trigger warning? Is that what
you... Could have done with trigger warnings. Yeah. So what's happened up until this point in Luther's writings on the Lord's Supper, they're really quite delightful in many ways. And I think Reformed readers can read some of the early stuff on Luther's writings on the Lord's Supper, enjoy them. You can read the Small Catechism by Luther, which comes from 1527, 1528, I think, as a Reformed person, and agree with almost everything that's said there, if not everything, because it picks up on the early emphasis. Luther's early emphasis was all on promise. He took the presence for granted. It wasn't an issue. He didn't have to argue for that. So he could focus on the Lord's Supper as we would say as Reformed believers, you know, sealing the promise on the heart. The Lord's Supper is something that presses the gospel home in physical form on us. So when I read early Reformation Luther on the Mass, I find it to be great stuff because the accent is on promise. What happens after Karlstadt, the Karlstadt debacle, and then the emergence of Zwingli with his symbolic understanding is that Luther refocus his attention on what we might now call the metaphysics of presence or the nature of predication in the Lord's Supper. What is meant when Christ says, this is my body, this is my blood? Is it, as Luther thinks, you know, to put it somewhat crudely, a literal statement? Or is it, as Luther argues, a symbolic statement? Again, we might, as Reformed or Evangelicals, step back and say, well, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is this. For Luther, Zwingli's taken Christ out of the sacrament.
Yeah. Right?
And he's turned the sacrament from something that does something for us, that seals the gospel on our heart, that strengthens our faith, into something we do. Either something we do as an aid memoir that casts our mind back to Calvary or binds us together with other believers. But it's not something that God does for us anymore. It's something we do for God. And here's the twist. That makes it akin to the Mass for Luther. Right. Because for Luther, the direction in the sacrament is from God to us. What's the problem with the Mass? The priest offers the elements up to God. What's the problem with Zwingli? Zwingli is doing something for God. So the irony is that the Mass and Zwingli are, for Luther, kind of two sides of the same coin, with this one difference. If you've got to make a choice, the Mass is better because at least they think Jesus is there.
Yeah, yeah.
So Zwingli is like the Mass.
It's even worse than the Catholics.
Only worse than the Catholics. Right. I had a little taste of this a couple of years ago when I was invited to speak at a Lutheran conference at the Concordia Seminary in Fort Wayne, where I was the only Reformed guy in this room, about 400 Lutheran pastors and theologians. And it was fascinating talking to Ron Ritgers afterwards, one of their professors of systematics, about how he was involved in ecumenical discussions with Roman Catholics in a way that he would never consider being in ecumenical discussion with the Reformed, because the issue was Christology for them. Christology relating to the Lord's Supper. That's the primary focus. So it's, you know, the background to the colloquy is not a trivial one. It's a serious theological issue.
Well, that certainly explains it.
Having said that, personalities play a lot into it as well, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue is very significant.
When as you describe it, Carl, I would be much more sympathetic, I think, with Luther than with Zwingli. Oddly enough, the concern that in the celebration of the Lord's Supper, it is what God is giving to us rather than what we're doing for Him.
Yeah,
I mean that. And now Zwingli's emphasis was upon the absence of Christ because He's at the Father's right hand. If I understand correctly.
Yeah, I mean Zwingli's argument is on one level, a Christological one with which I have tremendous sympathy in terms of what he's saying Christologically, and that is that the human flesh of Christ is spatially circumscribed. It's a body as you and I have that can only be in one place at one time. And therefore, if that body is at the right hand of the Father, it cannot be on the altar or it cannot be ubiquitous. On the table. And Luther is very, Luther's very interesting on Christology. I found something just recently where he's bashing away at the Council of Ephesus in 431 that he thinks concedes too much to the Nestorians. I always read Ephesus 431 as, torching the Nestorians in a rather brutal way. But for Luther, 431 is, it's not quite, it doesn't quite get it in 431 as Luther would like.
Just saying.
Well, often when we're speaking of the differences of Luther and Zwingli on this issue, it can be convenient as a Reformed person, particularly as one who follows in the kind of Reformed family tree of Calvin, to say, well, you've got transubstantiation on one end with the Catholics, and you have the real presence of Christ because the elements are transubstantiated. You have the substance of Christ there through this miracle of the Mass. And then you have on the far other side, Zwingli, who's a bare memorialist, and Christ isn't there in any way. But conveniently, we, the Calvinists, understand and don't fall into either of those errors. We're right in the middle with the real presence of Christ, the spiritual presence of Christ as he meets with his people and blesses them by faith. That becomes kind of a convenient dual caricature, but at the same time, well, because it is in essence kind of a caricature, kind of shortchanges the complexity, or I guess the depth of Zwingli's view. He was a memorialist of sorts, but maybe we want to say something more. You mentioned the symbolism there. He had a real sacramental notion.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I think that there isn't a Christian in this world who doesn't think that they're
right in the middle, without error.
To extremes, typically. The Lutherans probably see themselves as nicely placed between the Zwinglians and the Romans. I don't know.
Exactly.
But I think the way I would approach it, and I think this is part of what Calvin does, certainly most of the time, I mean, when he's deep in the weeds of some fairly ferocious controversies with the Lutherans, he perhaps doesn't always hold to this kind of line. But I think the key is not so much focusing on the presence initially, but focusing on the purpose. And that's why I like Luther's early writings, in a sense that the question Luther's asking there is, the question of presence is not an issue. So the question he's asking is why? Why is Christ present? And I think what Calvin tries to do is reorient the discussion in that way. I think Calvin is instinctively more sympathetic to Luther. He comments that I think it's when he's in Basel at one point, mixing with a bunch of guys who will go on in their different ways to become significant Reformed reformers. He's the one guy who favors the writings of Luther over Zwingli, and the reason he does that is Zwingli's. He's heard. I think he might even say he's heard. He'd heard that Zwingli's sacramental theology was very reductive. So there's definitely we might say a gravitational pull towards Luther for Calvin. And I've sometimes said this, and I've had pushback from people who probably know better than me, but there's a sense in which I think what Calvin's trying to do is salvage as much of Luther as he can on the basis of a sound Chalcedonian Christology.
Yeah, exactly.
If I could put it that way. And I think what Calvin and Zwingli share in common is the Christology. What Calvin and Luther share in common, at least the earlier Luther, is the question, why?
I got you.
Why is Christ present? It's not the metaphysical question, though that's important. It's that question of why.
Yeah.
What is sacrament doing? Mm-hmm. What is Christ in the sacrament doing?
Did Luther ever have an opportunity to read Calvin on his doctrine of the Lord's Supper, and did he make comment?
I've heard anecdotally that Luther read Calvin and said, if only I'd read this, I'd have been persuaded. Never found that firsthand. It sounds to me like a convenient.
Yeah, sure.
Right.
you know, it may be a bit of Catholic propaganda to make Luther look worse, or it may be Calvinistic propaganda to make Luther look better. Who knows? Deathbed conversions and third-hand stories that work in the favor of the person telling them are things that I tend to view with some skepticism.
So, Carl, the story of Luther throwing the tablecloth off the table at Marburg and there being the writing in chalk or whatever on the table, is that true?
As far as I know, yep, that's recorded in the early accounts. We have a couple of different accounts of Marburg. They're quite funny to read because one's a Lutheran account, one's a Reformed account. And if I remember correctly, in the one account, you know, Zwingli bursts into tears because he's seeing Christendom being torn asunder in front of him. And in the other one, Zwingli cries crocodile tears, sort of secretly satisfied that his plan to destroy the Christian faith is coming to fruition. The blog world has merely made the underlying nastiness of the Christian world more public and accessible.
It didn't engender it. It just disclosed it.
It's facilitated it. But Reformation pamphlets. Reformation pamphlets are worth reading just to be reminded that no, the standard of discourse has not declined.
Is there some sort of a Ebo for that, like an actual journal that people can find in libraries where you can read some of those?
Sure. I mean, if you've got Ebo, books online, if you've got access to that, you should be able to find some English Reformation
English ones
quite
right.
easily there.
That makes perfect
digital
sense.
The digital Reformation, post-Reformation library, I would imagine, would have some of that.
I mean, John Bale wrote some fairly, we might almost regard them as somewhat pornographic plays to undermine his opponents. And the Roman Catholics wrote pornographic plays about Luther and his marriage. It was bad. Very, very bad.
It's propaganda. It's like, anyway. That's wild. I'll just keep my mouth shut. That's crazy. So if you would, I'm curious to hear a little bit about Martin Bucer on some of this and some of his role, if as much as we might know, but he really wanted to find some true connection here theologically. He definitely had an ecumenical spirit about him and did everything he could. I'm not so sure that Bucer was the kind of guy who would compromise his own conviction. I think he had some conviction, but at the same time, he sometimes characterized as kind of a lowest common denominator Protestant, but he wanted to have a unity here among the Protestants rather than a splintered, fractioned group of Protestants that had no real unity against Rome. What was Bucer at work here? How much was he involved in terms of maybe drafting some of these articles? And then what did he do afterward when they couldn't find agreement?
Well, I think with Bucer, the first thing to comment is you've got to remember that, again, we talked about this a little bit earlier, the 16th century is a very different world. And when you're looking at Luther, Bucer, Zwingli, you're looking at men who grew to adulthood in a world where it would have been conceptually impossible to imagine the church being divided. Protestantism introduces divisions in Christendom that had never been seen before, and that these men who'd grown up in the Catholic Church would have had no intellectual apparatus for handling. They were, I often wonder whether, did Luther ever lie awake at night thinking, what have I wrought? I've shattered the church, and I have no tools for putting it back together. We've got to invent the tools as we go along. Secondly, I think the Bible puts a high premium on church unity, and for these men, that meant visible unity. That was the only unity out there. So, when Bucer comes along and is this generally regarded as the most ecumenical of the reformers, I'm almost inclined to say, but we might also categorize him perhaps as the one most heartbroken by the breaking up of the institutional church. This was not an easy thing or a light thing. And I mean, I'm on record as saying this, I'll say it again. I think this is one thing we can learn from Catholics, and that is commitment to church, visible church unity.
Well, they major on that for sure.
For most people, that's local church.
Yeah.
For most of us, we drift from one church to the other depending on our tastes. That would have been inconceivable for Bucer. So Butz's background is he's seeing this conflagration before his very eyes. What can he do to solve it? And he's a man who's involved in the Reformation from early on. You know, he's at the Heidelberg Disputation. He witnesses the Heidelberg Disputation. He sees Luther in action. And then he's at Marburg. And at Marburg, he really plays the role of a kind of go-between. He's the reformer of Strasbourg. He's trying to form reform the church within a city. So in some ways, he's a kind of Zwingli man. He's working in a similar context. On the other hand, he's a bit like Luther because he was a Dominican friar before he became a reformer. And he acts as something of a go-between, going between the parties and, you know, unfortunately declaring agreement when really agreement had only been achieved in linguistic formulation.
And mission again, accomplished. Just,
yeah, just I agree with you, Camden. I think he's being disingenuous there. I think he's doing what decent human beings instinctively do, and that's trying to read people in as charitable a way as possible. Right. And trying to persuade himself that there is real and substantial agreement. I don't think he's lying or being disingenuous. And of course,
I think Grayshot, if I'm getting the last name correct, in his biography of Butzer gets this right. And he does seem to indicate that maybe, you know, after the fallout of all this, he realized that as much as he wanted this ecumenical union, it wasn't possible. There was real difference.
Yeah. Yeah, real difference and real clash of personalities as well. I mean, Luther is a very, again, I've often said this in class, the thing about Luther is if he wasn't hard-nosed, he could never have survived the years 1517 to 1523.
Wow.
If you are hard-nosed, it means that when you're on the wrong side of a question or when you get the bit between your teeth on something, you're a hard person to shift. And Butzer just isn't. Butz is just not that kind of man. He's a more gentle, pastoral kind of spirit. I mean, he's the man who fixes Calvin up with his wife. He's the greater matchmaker of the Reformation. The aftermath of Butz, of course, he's most significant as the reformer of Strasbourg, where he develops a model of church life that is profoundly influential on John Calvin and shape Calvin's exile in Strasbourg for a while, pastor of the church exiles there. And he takes Butzer's ideas, particularly his idea of trying to separate the discipline of the church from the oversight of the state, which Butzer was pressing for in Strasbourg. That's what Calvin presses for in Geneva. Butzer has a round two on the Lord's Supper and leads to the Wittenberg Accord of 1536, where Butzer, so say, brings about this agreement between Lutheran and Reformed, but really the Reformed have to compromise on just about everything. And it's one of the more repellent episodes in some ways in Luther's own life, because Luther basically harangues Butzer. He reduces Butzer to tears in 1536. He breaks his spirit in the way that he treats Butzer. So poor old Butzer really was in some ways a martyr to the desire to bring brothers together in a theological way. Thankfully, Bob Kolb never reduced me to tears. Sometimes him forgetting to include the attachments on emails to me when he only checks his email once a week was excruciating.
Right.
But never Bob cried. And I get on very well. There was no haranguing on either side.
Never cried. A friend of ours likens Butzer. He says he's the Clowny of the Reformation.
I don't know Dr. Clowney well enough. Is that intended as a criticism or as a compliment?
You can take it as you will.
However you want.
He certainly wasn't the Machen of the Reformation.
No, there's not. Definitely.
We can agree on that.
What was the aftermath or fallout, or maybe a kinder word, more optimistic word would be legacy. What was a legacy of Marburg, especially looking to the Diet of Augsburg a little bit later?
The Marburg articles form the basis for the documents ultimately that are presented to the Diet of Augsburg in 1530, when a real bid is made to make the emperor. There's a real chance that the emperor might subscribe a Protestant confession and the empire becomes Protestant. In retrospect, there's no chance at all. But I think going back to then, everything was up for grabs. So Melanchthon drafts what's now known as the Augsburg Confession and presents it to the emperor. Zwingli drafts a set of articles to present them to the emperor. The emperor refuses to subscribe both. The emperor's refusal to subscribe is a more deadly decision for the Reformed than it is for the Lutherans. The emperor's already clearly he's never going to invade Wittenberg. He's not going to declare a war on one of his electors in order to deal with Luther. The emperor's policy by 1530 is clearly containment. Whatever they say about not tolerating Lutheranism, they're going to contain it as best they can. And the Lutherans really have no need. I mean, this is emerging even at Marburg, that the Lutherans have no need for reform support because A, they've got the emperor's number on that one, and B, they have sufficient Lutheran states and cities to stand firm, to make it impossible for the emperor to want to indulge in civil war. So even though the Lutherans are rejected at Augsburg, their position is relatively secure. They form the Schmalkaldic League, which is a military political alliance for the protection of Lutherans within the empire. And it's really the Reformed who are left vulnerable. And as you outlined earlier on, Switzerland, as we now call it, effectively descends into a kind of civil war between the Reformed and the Catholic cantons. And although the Reformed will establish a strong presence in Bern, for example, and then if we consider it a Swiss city, but it's kind of Swiss-French city, Geneva, it will not enjoy quite the political security that Lutherans will until the death of Luther. Everything changes when Luther dies, when the big man who's been holding them all together is off the scene. The emperor is much more confident in his ability to break the Schmalkaldic League, rightly confident in his ability to break the Schmalkaldic League.
Yeah. I love that Schmalkaldic League. Sometimes people might hear that today and think that's another comic book movie or something like that. You got the Justice League, you got the Schmalkaldic League, the Avengers.
It is kind of cool. I used to love talking about this mutual defense league. It was rather great. Yeah, the Protestants all armed to defend each other against the forces.
Can you imagine that today? Oh, goodness. Yeah. Talk about Second Amendment rights. That's really adds something.
I think it probably does happen in places like Idaho and Montana, but who knows?
Oh, goodness. Jeff, you got any final thoughts or follow-up questions for Dr. Truman?
Basically, what are good resources for people, a couple of books that you could recommend, Carl, for understanding the history and the theology of the Marburg Colloquy?
Well, it's a good question. I think one of the issues, of course, histories tend to be partisan, and because the stakes are so high, they tend to be rather obviously partisan. I would recommend getting at it initially biographically. Mm-hmm. I think I'd always go to Roland Bainton, Here I Stand, Martin Marty's little book on Martin Luther, for the Luther side of things. I'd recommend G.R. Potter, his biography of Zwingli, for a decent account of Zwingli's life. And if you want a short summary of Zwingli's theology, there's a little book by my own doctoral supervisor who goes under the pen name of W.P. Stevens. I think Zwingli's theology, which is a short version of his bigger book, is a nice summary of Zwingli's theology as a whole. Of course, there's the Carl Truman book you've mentioned that has a chapter that we both wrote together that lays out the differences. Then I think go to the primary texts. I think for Luther, read the catechism. The large catechism is good as a way of getting into Luther's theology. Early Luther's thinking on the Lord's Supper, I think the Babylonian captivity of the church has a great section there. Or on the Holy Mass, a treatise on the Mass, which is the New Testament. That's a good work as well. And on Zwingli, it's a bit like, did Zwingli write any good books? It'd have to go.
He didn't live that long, really. I mean, and there's reasons why his works aren't as
He's rapidly superseded by Bullinger and Calvin and the Reform Front. I mean, he dies young. I'm thinking of his A Friendly Exegesis. I think that's Zwingli. Go to A Friendly Exegesis and as a way of looking at his engagement with Luther.
I got one more kind of a speculative question for you. If there are some THM or PhD students somewhere out there listening or established scholars looking for something to do, and I'm sure they have plenty of their own ideas, what would be a thesis that you'd really like to read? I mean, that doesn't yet exist in this you know, subject matter.
In this area. That's an interesting one. I think we still await something really good in English on Martin Buber's Eucharistic theology. Again, Peter Stevens did work on the Holy Spirit and Buber, that there's some work there, but I think a good thorough study of Martin Buber on the Lord's Supper would be good.
Yeah.
And it might be interesting as well to see the role of patristic and medieval Christological patterns in the debate as well. I think that's something that we're becoming more and more aware of, that the particularly 4th, 5th century debates on patristic Christology shape the thinking, later Eucharistic thinking of the church in profound ways. I'd be interested to see how does that play out in some of the Reformation and post-Reformation writings.
Yeah, I'd read all of those. That sounds great. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. We always enjoy speaking with you, Carl. I mean, thanks for taking time out of your day to meet with us and do it on camera. We really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure.
It's great to be with you guys.
I want to point people back to where they ought to go. You can visit Grove City College online at gcc.edu. You can also head on over to the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals at alliancenet.org. And there you'll find information about the Alliance, and you can also head on over to the Mortification of Spin website directly from that landing page as well. So say hi to the folks over at Mortification, Carl, and of course everyone here. You can visit us online at reformedforum.org. You know, there you'll find information about all of our programs and upcoming events. You can register, and if you'd like to get a hold of us, you can do so perhaps most easily at mail@reformedforum.org. Of course, all the social media spots, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you name it. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.